Welcome to Rust Belt Science. I'm your host, Maggie Fink.
And I'm Shahir Risk.
And today we have with us Felipe Santiago Torrado, if I'm pronouncing that reasonably correctly. You are a professor here at the University of Notre Dame. And I'm very excited to have you because you are actually one of the first people I met when I interviewed here to come for my PhD. So I don't know if you remember that. It was a while ago.
I remember meeting you. I didn't know it was...
I knew a few people already, but you were my first interview during my interview weekend. And at the time, I was not interested in microbiology at all or biology in general. I was more interested in biochemistry. But then you and I talked for longer than our allotted time, and it was really fun, and I learned a lot about fungus during that time. So having you here today to talk a little bit more about your research and what you do here at Notre Dame, I'm very excited. So welcome to the podcast.
Awesome. I'm very happy to be here too.
Very good. All right. We start off with one question for every guest that has something to do with your science. Your answer might, but we want to know if you are reading, watching, or listening to anything interesting right now that you want to just share with people.
You're going to put me in the spotlight.
Yes.
Yeah, that was, I did not include that question in the list we sent you.
No, it's funny. About reading, I haven't read anything outside papers in a long time. I usually, if there's like an interesting book, my wife is the one that read it.
Mm.
And then at night I tell her like, oh, tell me about it.
So you get the summary.
I get the summary. Yeah. I get the summary, and I don't have to spend too much time on that.
That's clever.
But in terms of book, but in terms of watching, there's a whole bunch of things that watching right now. Sometimes I can't do it. You know, I have to put them on hold. But I like sci-fi things. Mm-hmm. There's this show For All Mankind.
Okay. I think I've heard of that.
For All Mankind.
For All Mankind. Uh-huh. It's a pretty good show. Yeah. It's just basically an alternative universe where the Russia wants the space race.
Ooh. Oh, okay. Yes, I think I've heard of this.
Yeah, and then what will happen? It's pretty good. Yeah.
Okay.
And from what I understand, they were pretty close. They were winning on many fronts.
Yeah, I mean, they were the first. Yeah, they were the first in many things. Yeah. You know, first sending a dog, space, first sending a capsule to space. Yeah. US just won the first to put in a man.
Moon landing,
It's an interesting show.
Very interesting.
Nothing to do with, fungal infections, but.
That's good. I think, we as scientists should do things other than what we study. So
for sure.
Seems like a lot of people who've come on answer that question with something sci-fi related. If they're not, sometimes they're like, no, I don't do anything but read about science. But if they are reading anything else, it seems to be sci-fi is like the number one genre of.
Yeah, so far that's been the case.
Yeah.
Well, I also, I like a lot, especially when they do use some real science.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And they put that there, it makes it very believable and even feasible.
Yeah.
I think that's awesome when they do that.
That's the imagination part where, imagine what it would be like if this happened.
Yes.
And that's the fun part. And I think that's kind of where we start out as scientists to begin with.
Correct.
What would happen if this was the case? And then we call that an experiment. And then we go in the lab and do it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, yeah.
Well, you study pathogenic fungi, which is not something that I haven't met a lot of people in that field. Is it a very big field? It seems like it's kind of underfunded, maybe, is what I've heard. Why is that? And why is it kind of not as expansive?
So it is not a big field. And I think it's mostly because it's a newer field.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you think about it, if you think about some other more well-known pathogens like TB or, the plague, they have been studied since the 1800s. Scientists have been looking at them and studying them for hundreds of years.
And those are bacteria.
Correct.
Yeah, those are bacteria. Right.
Those are bacteria, correct. While if you think about fungi, it basically, really, we started seriously studying them in the 80s.
Wow. I didn't know that.
So you think about it, it's pretty recent.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And And Shahir, to answer your question, yeah. So fungi also, people, when people think about fungi, they I think most people, the first things that comes to mind is like mushrooms.
Yes.
Or things like that. Mm-hmm. So they don't associate fungi with disease.
Okay.
Or you might do, if you work in agriculture, then you know a lot of the crops disease are fungi. But but I don't think people associate, you know, fungi with something bad happening to you.
Like a human disease.
Like a human disease, yes. Yeah. So while people associate bacteria and viruses very easily with human disease. Yeah. And there's also, I think there's also, to that is the point that it's just very recently that they have become very common human pathogens. And so for most people from the late audience, I think they still don't associate that.
Sure. Yeah. So why has it been a more recent thing that we're seeing them in disease since the 80s specifically?
Yeah, I mean, you probably know, I mean, most people will, if you ask something that happened very big in the 80s related to infectious diseases, most people will think about HIV.
HIV and AIDS, yeah.
And indeed, that's, I think that's what started all. So, so humans, during evolution, we became very resistant to fungi.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, fungi are everywhere. They surround us. We're exposed to them all the time. And so I think over evolution, we just became very good at keeping them at bay.
Yeah.
Then came along HIV, and it started like eroding those defenses.
Right.
And then people started getting all these very bad infections. And in fact, many of the original AIDS-defining illnesses are fungal infections.
Oh, really? Yeah. I didn't know that.
So that these are things that would not infect anyone with a healthy immune system,
correct.
But then now they're,
correct. And then what happens is that, you know, over the 2 decades after AIDS was identified, then we became good at treating AIDS. And more people nowadays can live normal life using these highly antiretroviral treatments.
Right.
And so then fungal infections kind of starting to go down again, and then all of a sudden they started going up.
Oh.
And there's many reasons. And ironically, they are medical advances that we have developed in the last decades that they are good for certain type of diseases, like steroid treatments. Now you can treat autoimmune diseases, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Organ transplantation has become more and more common and successful. Yet, for you to not reject the organ, they have to immunocompromise you.
Right. So they have to suppress your immune system so you don't reject the heart or the lung or the liver that you're getting.
Exactly. And the same thing with the steroids. When you have an autoimmune disease, it's just your own immune system is harming you. So they have to suppress that so they doesn't harm you. And then the side effect of all these medical advances is that you become very susceptible to fungal infections.
Right. Yeah.
And there's also all sort of other metabolic diseases that are more common now that weren't as common in the past, like diabetes and obesity. And other types of metabolic diseases that also indirectly affect your immune system and also make you susceptible to fungal infections. So even though we're becoming better at controlling HIV, there's other populations now that are becoming more susceptible to fungal infections, and that's why cases are going up again.
Wow, that's a very interesting perspective on how the diseases have progressed over the last 40 or 50 years.
And there's even more controversial ones that I can mention if you guys want.
Yeah, please. Yes, this is the place for controversy. Yes.
There's this idea of climate change creating new pathogens.
Mm.
And there's this one very likely example called Candida auris that prior to 2009, there was never a report of Candida auris causing disease in humans.
Yeah.
It basically was a fungus living in waterways, living in the environment, not causing any disease. And then after 2009, in the next few years after that, then they start diseases caused by these fungus start appearing throughout the whole globe. And they were appearing simultaneously. And when people start looking at the genetics, at the genomes, they were all different. It's not like one person got infected and traveled the whole world and spread that one particular. No, these were appearing simultaneously, completely independently from each other. And what was the common thing? They were appearing in places that are tropical, very hot, throughout the world. And what's the common thing is that these places are getting warmer. And then years after, there were some physicians that went back and looked at some of these strains that may have been kept at hospitals, you know, in different repositoriums. And they were looking at very, very early strains. And when they test to see if those strains could grow at high temperature, they can't. But these newer strains that can cause disease, they can grow at high temperature.
They can grow at higher temperatures.
So the idea is that, again, you know, this is a reasonable idea. It would be hard to prove. But the idea is that because all these natural environment, these natural habitats where these fungus live was getting warmer, then you were selecting for those, for the ones that were able to now grow at high temperature. And that was the barrier that was keeping them from causing disease.
Okay.
Because we are, you know, we're warm-blooded.
Right.
So that was, they could not grow at high temperature. That was keeping them. But now they can.
So one of the defenses that we have or had, I guess, is having that relatively high body temperature, 98.6 degrees Fahrenheit or 37 degrees Celsius, to stop them from growing because they would overheat essentially.
Correct.
Typically. But now with climate change, we're seeing them adapt to higher temperature. And the idea is that now they're infecting us or they can, they have the potential.
Exactly, yeah.
And they're finding many ways to do that. It's not just a single mutation.
Correct, no. Yeah. And if you think about it, you know, this environment, you know, these fungi live at room, in the environment at room temperature. You know, they are adapted to that temperature. Yeah. There's no need for them to, like, grow at very cold temperature or very high temperature. Yeah. They just grow at, you know, room temperature. So that's why if you think about during evolution, warm-blooded animals usually are very resistant to fungal infections.
Yeah.
Versus reptiles and amphibians are very susceptible.
And
to
plants
infections.
Too.
And plants, correct.
Yeah.
Wow. So fungi, they're not bacteria. They are eukaryotes like we are, but they also are like their own thing. Like they have a lot of traits to bacteria in some ways, but then, you know, they have the characteristics of what we classify a eukaryote. Can you talk a little bit about fungi in general and what makes them, you know, why they're fungi and their differences between bacteria? I think it's something I'm not as, you know, we don't learn about fungi as much in microbiology courses or anything like that. So can you talk a little bit about some of those basics?
Yeah, you know, in very general terms, you know, if we look at all at the tree of life, if we look at all the organisms that are considered to be alive, you know, we have three big, like, kingdoms. We have the archaea, we have the bacteria, and then we have the eukaryotes. And the difference between these is basically, in the most general terms, is that eukaryotes have, like, a very distinct nuclei that contains all, you know, the genomic content, and the other ones don't.
Right.
So bacteria, they're either in the prokaryotes or in the archaea, and then fungi are in the eukaryotes. And that's where we are, too. Humans are eukaryotes. So in that sense, fungi are more similar to us than to bacteria. And even though they can be some fungi that are unicellular, just a single cell like bacteria, we call those yeast. But they are also multicellular, like molds or like mushrooms that you see. Those are fungi, but those are multicellular. So I think one of the, you know, what makes them very challenging to treat is, in fact, this, how this resemble that they have to us, how closely they are to us. Like if you think about it, bacteria and even viruses, they're so different that through research, we have been able to identify very specific things that we that are only present in viruses and bacteria.
Yeah.
And so we can target that. And that way, those, you know, antibiotics and antivirals are, in a way, are very safe. because we're just targeting that very specific thing. Mm-hmm. But with fungi, they're so close to us, it's hard to find something that is only in the fungi and not in us. And that's why there's very few antifungals, and then the ones that exist, they also have a lot of side effects. And so that's one of the things that makes this very challenging, these infections very challenging. And it's mostly it's just because they're very similar to us.
So it's hard to find that silver bullet that's going to hurt them without hurting us at the same time.
And then to something that you mentioned before, you said that, you know, one of the main defenses that we have was our temperature.
Yes.
And in fact, there's basically three big things that a fungi have to overcome to cause disease. One is that it has to be able to grow at high temperature.
Right.
Second one is that it has to be able to avoid our immune system. And the third one is that it has to be able to search and find nutrients and energy once it's inside us.
Yes.
Which people might think about this and they might say, you know, it's inside us. They're going to find, you know, a lot of nutrients. Yeah. It's actually, it's very inhospitable.
Yeah.
When a fungus or any organism gets inside us, it's very hard. It's a very inhospitable place. So they have to overcome these three things. And then you think about it. So with the climate change, the example that we talked before, they overcome that thermal barrier.
Yeah.
With AIDS, you know, AIDS was one of the big things that caused this incidence in fungal infection, because during AIDS, then they're able to overcome the immune system barrier.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And then in terms of like finding food, that is not a problem for fungi. If you think about it, they live in many weird places in the environment.
Yes. Yeah.
They need to be able to find and search and find food in the environment. So they do have ways to do that in the environment. They can use those same ways inside us.
Wow.
So the better the fungus is to like find and grow in the environment, most probably the easier it would be to also do the same inside us.
Right. So they can, just like they scavenge things out in the environment, they can do that in our bodies.
And that's why some fungi, if you think about it, like, you know, Baker's yeast, you know, Saccharomyces cerevisiae, in the environment, it basically only lives in a grapevine. It's on top of a little grape. Yeah. It doesn't have to do much. The grape provides a lot of it. So that particular one doesn't have to like search and scavenge a lot, doesn't have those skills. So if you get infected with Saccharomyces, it will not do much to you because it cannot grow high temperature. It doesn't have the skills and the tools to like scavenge.
Yeah.
Now you go into like a dead tree in the middle of a forest, you'll see a lot of moldy, you know, filamentous stuff growing on the dead tree.
Yeah.
Most likely that's Aspergillus. It does have a lot of tools and skills to like go and secrete and degrade stuff and get food. So it can use those same tools and strategies inside you. So then Aspergillus have an edge over Saccharomyces. Aspergillus, if it gets inside, it can cause disease in the absence of these other two things, like the immune system and the thermal barrier.
And the temperature. Yeah, I see. So that's a very important factor, is how good they are at scavenging food.
Correct.
So this is why yeast is pretty harmless.
I mean, that's why, you know, we yeast is great. You know, we drink wine, we make bread, in that sense, it's great.
Wow.
Yeah, it seems, so when I think of like a fungal disease, fungal infection in humans, it's almost what I imagine always topical. It's kind of the more common. Why is it typically a more topical infection? And then I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more too about more serious infections that do become internal. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Great. I mean, and that's a great question. If you think about it, your skin, outside your skin, is cooler than inside.
The temperature again.
So they typically can, you know, under certain conditions, you know, they could grow and spread in your skin and sustain themselves in your skin, but they will not be able to go invasive inside. And one of the reasons will be, you know, the temperature. Another reason is that the skin is part of our immune system too.
Of course.
You know, skin is like a physical barrier. It's a physical barrier. And we do have, you know, immune cells, and we do have molecules that are in the skin that defend us. But then, you know, that's one reason why when we get them, you know, it's usually in the superficial layers. But the other thing I want to mention is that, like I think I said this before, fungi are everywhere.
Right.
They're everywhere. So we're exposed to them all the time. There are, you know, these estimates that in a single day we inhale anywhere from hundreds of them to thousands of them.
Wow.
We inhale them.
Just inhale.
But if you're healthy, you're fine. You know, you can keep it. You can control them. But we're exposed to them all the time. And also something that people might not think about it. We also have fungi as part of our flora. Like they live normally, you know, on us. And those fungi are, you know, they over evolution, they have become something essential.
Part of who we are.
Part of who we are, yeah. Wow. And we have, now under certain conditions of medical, you know, I'm blanking on the word now, like if you required some kind of, like a prosthesis or something like that.
Like a prosthetic.
A prosthetic or something like that. That's not normal, right? Mm-hmm. So some of those same fungi that we have can take advantage of that. Mm-hmm. They're going to go and say, like, oh, look at that. There's some metal platform in here.
Yeah.
Looks very different than a bone. Looks very different than skin. Let's go there. And then they can form a biofilm in that.
And colonize
And then
that
colonize
area.
That.
Wow. Yeah.
So they can be opportunistic in that way.
Yes. Correct. Yeah. Another thing, when you have to have something like that, when you have to have something artificial put inside you, you're also breaking in a way your own immune defenses.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So again, you're like targeting these three main barriers that keep them at bay, and then you're making them weaken. And so fungi can take advantage of that.
So one of the things, let's say I get a fungal infection on my skin, I don't have that temperature, not the same. And then all of a sudden I get this inflammation, right? And my body, you know, it gets more circulation and I can feel it get warmer there, or even if I have a fever. Do you think that's our natural defense to get a fever, to warm up so that we're putting more stress on these pathogens, especially fungi?
Correct. So sometimes, you know, it's funny that you say that. Sometimes in my undergrad class, I usually ask my students, you know, what do you think inflammation is?
Yeah.
And the first thing that they think about it is like this redness, this, you know, swelling.
Soreness.
What that is just basically immune cells coming, like swarming that area. They're coming into the area. They're responding to something foreign, and they're coming in and then taking care of it. So with fungi, that's, if they want, if you have them in your skin and somehow they try to go in, that's going to cause this inflammation.
Yeah.
All these immune cells are going to come in, you know, the swelling and the redness is because there's more blood flow, there's more immune cells coming in, and then they will take care of this fungi and then keep it at bay.
That's cool.
That is super cool. I remember when I first learned that fungi were an important part of our microbiome, and we just kind of, doesn't seem like people are really studying that. They're like, yeah, they're there, but as compared to bacteria, we don't really understand quite as much what the important things they do for us, but we're like, they're there. That's about the extent I've been able to.
Yeah, no, and it's funny, not just with fungi, you know, with the microbiome in general. Mm-hmm. Like 40 years ago, I think one of the main ideas was that our body was sterile.
Yeah,
we didn't even have bacteria inside us.
Right.
And then some researchers start putting forward these ideas, and they were like, "Oh, you're crazy!" and now we, you know, it's pretty much accepted. Like, you know, the microbiome is essential for many developmental, you know, stages and for many, you know, bodily processes.
Right.
So it's essential. So we just keep, you know, learning more and more about this. And
that's cool.
But still, you know, even in the microbiome field, you know, a lot of people have focused on the bacteria.
Yeah.
But we do have fungi, and we do have like protists.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's part of us.
Man, we are. Every time this comes up, it's always mind blowing to me that, like, there's just so much. We're not alone in our bodies. We have all these things going on, and it's. I like to bring up the idea that bacteria and fungi, they're not just pathogenic. There's all these other ways these things exist in the world that are really essential to us. But people just want to fund disease stuff, so that's what people have to talk about. But I just want to remind people that they're good. There's good bacteria. There's good fungi that. Yeah. We need and are essential.
There's a fungi inside all of us.
Yes, definitely. And the funny thing is that a lot of people don't realize it. Sometimes, you know, another thing that I talk with my students, and they usually don't realize that, you know, I tell them dandruff, you know, when you have dandruff, that's actually the manifestation of a fungal disease.
Wow.
Uh-oh.
Adley's foot, you know,
Adley's foot is
a fungal disease. A ringworm in your skins, usually those are fungal disease. And usually students are like, "Oh, really, dandruff? I thought that was like dry scalp or something like that." Yeah. You know, they don't realize.
But
that's
a response to a fungal skin infection.
Yeah.
Well, we've encountered some athlete's foot in my house of teenage boys who play sports. I'm
wonderful.
Like, get this taken care of. We can get rid of that fungi. I don't care for that one.
No, that's not good.
And that's also, you know, it's funny that you said that. You were like, oh, girl, we can take care of that. You were kind of like, you know, dismissing it, right? So I think that's another reason why fungal infections, people usually don't associate them with like invasive fungal infections. Yeah. Like people think like, oh yes, Adley's foot. You don't die of Adley's foot.
Yeah.
You know, they might think about, you know, ringworms or you know, those type of superficial infections. Like, you don't die of that. Mm. So that's another, I think another reason why general population don't realize how deadly fungal infections can be.
Right.
When you hear the word meningitis, you know, like a brain infection, you immediately think like on bacteria or some viruses. Yeah. You never think about fungi.
Right.
You think about pneumonia, you know. You immediately think like, oh, some kind of bacterial infection of the lungs. You never think about fungal pneumonia.
Fungal pneumonia,
And those are the type of very bad, invasive infections that I study in my lab.
Right. So that's actually one of the questions.
Perfect segue.
One of the organisms that you study is called Cryptococcus neoformans, right? And it can be found in the poop of flying tree rats. First of all, what's a flying tree rat? And then what happens when people actually get infected with this microbe?
Yeah, so I'm not sure about flying tree rats.
Shahir, you just...
I've seen that term.
Shouldn't believe everything you find on the internet.
I know, right?
I imagine you're talking about pigeons.
Pigeons, they are flying tree rats, basically.
So Cryptococcus neoformans is one of the most common invasive fungal pathogens. And is one of the reason I think is one of the most common is because it's present worldwide in the environment. It's associated with like bird guano in general.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in caves where there's bats, you know, seagulls, all those types of birds, you know, with the guano. And interestingly, you know, there's this idea that one of the reasons that crypto is everywhere in the world is because birds are kind of carriers, and they fly around and they poop everywhere, and so they disseminate it.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah, birds are everywhere.
Yes, they are.
Which is funny because then, you know, back home in Puerto Rico and in most of the older colonial cities, there's usually a place in the old plaza where people go and feed
the pigeons. Yes,
usually there's so many pigeons there that the whole place is just filled with like poop everywhere. And you know, I've seen pictures, and even I did that when I was smaller. I remember like getting like food on me so that they will come
and land
on me and then poop on me too. And then now I go to these places like, oh my God, there's so much crypto in here.
Yeah, exactly.
Cause everywhere.
Because you're seeing what people can't see.
Yeah,
exactly. You're just, seeing through the poop.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
So this is one of those examples when I was telling you that, you know, we're exposed to it all the time. You know? We are exposed to it all the time, yet we don't get sick all the time because of our evolution. We developed these very, very good protective measures.
Right.
And those protective measures are the ones that are kind of getting weakened now in recent years.
And so sometimes those can become infections and they can become serious infections. So tell us a little bit more about
that. So with Cryptococcus, for example, typically you inhale it and it goes to your lungs. And if you're a healthy person, you do get infected. You know, you have crypto in your lungs, but you don't develop symptoms. And either one or two things can happen. You are completely clear the crypto, or you just keep it at bay so it's latent and it remains for you for decades. But it doesn't cause any problem. There's no symptoms. And in fact, there's this idea that many of the cases that happen later on in life is because as you age, then you start getting all these other, you know, diseases to like chronic diseases, for example, that will weaken your immune system. And so then you crypto reactivates and now it can cause diseases. But if you're healthy, you can control it, no symptoms. Now, if something happened to your immune system, then crypto can disseminate. So it can exit your lungs. And for reasons that are not very clear, you know, after years of research, crypto shows this predilection for your brain. So it gets out of your lungs and it just goes to your brain. Now, it's not very clear how. It could be that it just goes everywhere, but in every other organ, your immune system is able to clear it, but not in your brain. Or it could be that it just goes to your brain.
Right.
We just don't know. Yeah. But the thing is that it goes to your brain, and then it causes this brain infection, and almost the, you know, more than 90% of all the crypto cases, all the crypto fatalities, are because of brain infections.
So that's when it, because it, when it goes to the brain and does some damage.
Yes, and you know, as you probably and you know, brain has some very good defenses. You don't want things to go inside the brain. Right. Very few organisms can actually cross, you know, past these defenses. Crypto is one of those. Yeah. And once it gets into your brain, then it is pretty hard to treat for various reasons. One is that these very same defenses that the brain has to prevent organisms to go in also prevent drugs to go in.
So we call that, so, you know, of course, we call this the blood-brain barrier.
Correct.
Right, so preventing just anything that's floating in the blood to go in.
That's, you know, and that applies not just, you know, cancer. Brain cancers are one of the most aggressive and, you know, mortal cancers. Why? Because it's also, your immune system also have a hard time getting into the brain to, like, target these cancers. And so it's just that, it's just like a double-edged sword, so you want to keep the brain environment intact in order for the brain to work fine. So you have these very strong defenses. But then if you need your immune system to go in, you also are handicapped.
You're locked out still.
So once crypto gets into the brain, then it is pretty hard to treat. And in fact, you know, 20%, 20 to 25% of HIV deaths, HIV-associated deaths, are because of cryptococcal meningitis.
The brain infection part.
So crypto is the second infectious disease cause of death. The first one is TB for HIV, but crypto is the second one.
Wow, I did not know that. I was always terrified of meningitis when I was a kid. Like, I knew a few kids who died from fungal meningitis.
Oh, really? Really?
Yeah. Here in Indiana, there was, I don't know if there was like a little outbreak or something, but when I was probably 13, I knew somebody who did. And it was just like this terrifying thing. Like, it was so rare. Then you're basically dead because it's so difficult to treat.
Yeah. That's... And I think it's interesting that you said that because, you know, I think early in the 90s that's when the meningococcal meningitis vaccine came.
Yeah.
And then around, I think maybe a few years before that, that was the streptococcal meningitis vaccine came out. And prior to that, there were hundreds of thousands of kids dying
from
these meningitis. These are bacterial meningitis. And they were dying of that. And then the vaccines came out. And then that pretty much, at least here in the U.S., cases went down. Mm-hmm. There are other places still where that type of disease is pretty high. The incidence is pretty high. But I think that's another reason why people also think about bacterial infections, mm-hmm. because these two big, very big infectious diseases of the brain were bacterial.
Mm-hmm.
And fungi ones were very rare. So it's interesting to hear that you.
It was a pretty traumatic thing. Like nobody
couldn't do anything.
It just didn't happen here,
correct.
Especially.
And so. I can imagine that, you know, back, you know, early, you know, 2000s. I think more physicians now are more aware of it, but mm-hmm. I'm sure that back then it's also not the first thing in your list, right?
Right.
And so
right.
that delay in the diagnosis also contributes to the mortality.
Because, and prognosis,
because, you know, physicians are stumped. They just, I just don't know what you have. And then that's that delay, and that makes it even worse to treat.
And it gets more serious over time. Yeah. Right.
You've been studying this, and you have a pretty cool paper about how they're actually able to cross that blood-brain barrier. And I remember when you were telling me about this during my interview, I was like, this is the coolest thing I've ever heard. Can you talk about it and kind of this Trojan horse, as you call it, and why they're able to get to our brain?
Yeah, so back when I started working with cryptococcus, there were already these three hypothesis,
mm-hmm.
three ideas that not just apply to cryptococcus. You know, it could apply, in theory, they could apply to any pathogen that can mm-hmm. survive mm-hmm. inside immune cells.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So you could imagine any pathogen that can survive inside the immune cells can use that cell as a taxi to move around your mm-hmm. body. And if you think about it, it's pretty smart, because not only you're kind of hidden inside an immune cell, you're protected from other immune cells, but then as that immune cells move around your body, it's taking that pathogen around your body.
It's a taxi.
Yeah, it's like a taxi. Well. So the idea when I started working on that, the idea was that, you know, can that truly happen? Is that something that we could visualize happening? Mm. And indeed, I used this in vitro model of a blood-brain barrier, and in collaboration with some other labs from cell biology labs, that we developed this model to grow them on agarose pad that mm-hmm. simulated like the extracellular matrix.
Right, so you didn't ask for volunteers to give you their brains.
I'm doing all of this in vitro.
Okay, so this is just
no need to ask for people's samples. But we wanted to, like, you know, try to like develop a system that mimic that.
Right.
And so I will take human blood monocytes, mm-hmm. and then infect them with crypto.
Wow. The human immune cells.
Correct. Yeah. So human mm-hmm. from, you know, typically we have them in our bloods. They're mm-hmm. going all everywhere in our bodies. So I can take, you know, platelets. Like people only need platelets.
Yeah,
you know, there were donors that would just come to donor their platelets, but then for that particular donation, they don't care about the immune cells. They only care about platelets. Yes. So then I could get all these leftover immune cells and use them.
So just people just donating blood, essentially.
Yes,
that's
we
all
just
they
go
need.
To the
so
hospital.
You don't have to cut people open.
So not that. And then I could get all these, you know, I have that source. I could use that.
Uh-huh.
Then I could like select for blood monocytes uh-huh. and infect them. And then I could use the ones that were only infected uh-huh. and then put them on top of this blood-brain barrier and then image them.
Yeah.
And then lo and behold, what I could, you know, very easily see is that these, especially when I added some inflammatory, you know, molecules mm-hmm. to mimic like an infection. So these immune cells will just cross the blood-brain barrier, and they're crawling in one side of it with the fungus inside. Then they will cross it, and they will keep crawling on the other side of it with the fungus inside.
Wow.
Now, having said that, that was in vitro.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But presumably, if they're able to do that in vitro, they can also do it in vivo.
In a living system, yes.
Correct. Yeah. They could also do it in vivo. Although that's something that's harder to like.
Right.
Yeah, I can imagine that'd be much more difficult. So
I don't need my brain for anything.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
Volunteer. First volunteer.
Yeah, make a little window with your skull.
Yeah, exactly.
Put a little microscope there.
Yes.
That's right. There you go.
All for science.
So essentially, once that immune cell's on the other side, in the brain, then the cryptococcus can just like hop on out and
correct. And that's another amazing thing that crypto does is that it basically exits the immune cells.
It comes out of the Trojan horse. Yeah.
And it's really something it has been shown to be induced by the fungus. So if you have like a dead fungi, then it doesn't happen. So it has to be alive.
Yeah.
But the cool thing is that people have seen that with other environmental, like amoebas, for example. They have seen that they can eat something and then spit it out.
Mm.
Yeah. And both, you know, the amoeba and whatever they spit out, you know, they follow their merry lives.
Yeah.
So the same thing happened with crypto. It happens with immune cells where crypto is just hanging out inside. And then for whatever reason, at some point, it gets spit out.
Yeah.
And both the crypto and the immune cells, they just follow their own way.
Mm-hmm.
So you could imagine a situation where that happens once it's inside the brain.
The brain barrier. Mm-hmm. And then just it basically liberates and says, thank you very much for
correct.
The ride.
And then some other things that I also saw while doing this is that it can come out before the immune cell crosses the barrier.
Right. Okay.
But then that free fungi now that is now next to the blood-brain barrier can interact with that cells that form the blood-brain barrier, and then those cells themselves can eat the fungus.
Okay.
That's another way that the fungus can cross. Uh-huh. It can, you know, the cells can eat it in one side, and then the fungus gets spit out on the other side.
I see. So,
and then the third way that crypto can cross, and again, many of these pathways can apply to any pathogen that goes into the brain, is that the edges, you know, the blood-brain barrier is made by these many cells that are touching each other, and the edges of the cells are sealed.
Right.
And that's why it's a barrier, because all of these cells are forming this barrier, and whenever the cells touch each other, that area is sealed.
So they're holding on to each other correct. Very, very tightly.
Correct.
Yeah.
So crypto and many other pathogens that are able to get into the brain, they have enzymes, they have these little molecules that cut open those seals.
Perfect. We love enzymes.
We love enzymes on this show. Wow.
Yes.
And so then they can grow, they can pass through, not through, but in between.
Mm-hmm. By digesting through the little barriers.
So they have these enzymes, you know, metalloproteases that will also digest the matrix, and then they can just go between the cells.
I mean, fungi are really good at digesting things.
Yes.
Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. Correct.
They eat tree bark.
That's what exactly. That's how they survive. They and ecologically, you know, they are very important because of that.
That eating
they're
dead
basically
things.
Recycling. Wonderful. You know, all the biological material, making it available for other things to like survive. So they're very important. Which reminds you like a very funny anecdote. I was once talking about fungi, and it was like a public audience, and then this little kid at the end asked me, like, if they're so bad, why don't you get like a flamethrower? And then you go and burn them all.
Such a kid thing.
It was very funny. It's like, and then I had to tell you, you know, I mean, you can do that, but you have to take into consideration that fungi do very good things too.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to go and burn them all. You know, they are very important for the, you know, recycling of materials in the world. And they do, you know, they also are a food source for us. You know, you don't want to like go and burn them.
Burn everything.
But it was it's a very funny question.
This might seem like a childish idea, but in fact, when germ theory first came out, and we realized that diseases, many infectious diseases, came from bacteria, and we were able to make antibiotics. Mm-hmm. The idea was, let's just get rid of all bacteria.
Yes.
Right. So it was the flamethrower approach. This is not so childish. You know, we were thinking about that. And of course, like you said, we realized that these microbes are actually very good for us.
They're not all that bad. Yeah.
So kids are not so far off from what we think.
Yeah, kids have a good instinct, I guess. Sure. But maybe not a flamethrower.
Maybe not a flamethrower. Although that would be cool, but
Yeah, I have all kinds of stuff growing out in my garden and my soil. I mean, some of it I don't want, but I've got my compost pile, and you can just see the white webbing and stuff. And they're important for everything.
You know, and one of the main components of a compost are fungi.
Fungi, yeah.
Yeah, that's fungi.
I'm always kind of scared of them. I grew up in Egypt, and we don't have a lot of fungi that grow in Egypt naturally. There are some, of course, but most of them are probably microscopic. They grow on plants that grow there. We have huge cotton crops and, you know, corn and, you know, all kinds of things and beans. But you don't see that, the mushrooms that you see. And that's why whenever I see these mushrooms in my backyard, I'm always like, okay, don't touch it, because it's probably going to kill you or, you know, infect your brain and grow out of it.
That's
kind of
it's funny that you mentioned that because my kid, you know, he sees mushrooms like that and he's like, oh, so nice, and he wants to like get them, and he's like, oh, he immediately wants to like touch them, and I'm like, don't clean your hands after that, you know.
Well, I have to say, I have two cousins who live in Australia, and as you know, Australia is you know, everything will kill you. Well, one of them is married to an Australian woman, and the other one, the younger one, came to visit them and woke up early in the morning and decided, you know, that he wants to pay back their hospitality by making breakfast, found this beautiful mushroom in the backyard, went to pick it up, and luckily his sister-in-law saw him. She's an Australian, and she screamed. She just screamed because it was a very, very deadly mushroom, and he probably would have killed all of them.
I think, you know, I cannot tell which, you know, apart, which ones are edible, which ones are not.
Very difficult.
But that's why I just like don't eat. You see something like that?
Leave it alone.
And, you know, and it's funny you said that. Even the ones that are not deadly, you know, if you think about it, LSD and these types of, like, you know, psychedelic things, they're coming from, most of the time, from mushrooms, you know, most of the time from fungi. Fungi makes all these, you know, neuroactive, you know, compounds that.
So, are they controlling our brains?
Yeah,
I mean, let's just get down to it. That's an awesome question.
Yeah, I mean, they produce all sort of these neuroactive components, and in fact, if you look over evolution, there are many examples of fungi that can control, in a way, you know, control the behaviors and the actions of other organisms.
Ooh, I like that. Tell us more about that. That's super cool.
You just want to get them to talk about cats and toxoplasma.
There's that too. But there are species of fungi in the rainforest that, in fact, ants.
So the ants, So the ants are the most, you know, I think those are the most widely known.
Yeah.
Probably because David Attenborough's.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's stunning footage of that. Yeah. And so,
So they're very widely known. But in fact, there's many insects. You know, the bees can be, flies can be controlled. It's not just ants, just many insects. And over evolution, these fungi have evolve ways to manipulate these organisms. Now, something I want to say, clarify, because they can manipulate like this insect, it doesn't mean that they can go and manipulate us or other organisms.
That's what they want you to think.
So they're very organism specific.
They're very specific, yes. And the reason they do that, which is to me is always amazing how evolution works, like it doesn't matter what type of fungus is doing it to what type of other organisms. You know, the reason they're always doing it is to reproduce and spread.
For survival.
Yeah, that's reproduce and spread. And it's just amazing to me. Like, it doesn't matter if it's an ant or a fly or whatever. They usually force the ant to go to the highest point possible. Mm-hmm. And once, you know, if it's a little ant, goes up a tree and it goes to the highest branch, and then it forces the ants to like lock its jaws over there.
Yeah.
And then it dies.
Yeah.
And then out of the ant, then the fruiting body with this part of the fungi that makes the spores grows out of it and then disperses the spores. And because it's on the top of a tree, you know, now you could imagine the air will pick up the spores and the spores will go everywhere. And not only that, usually ants make their anthills near a tree. So you then all of the spores that have been spread on the top will fall mm-hmm. on that anthill. And then you just like the whole thing goes again.
And these are hundreds of thousands, millions, yes. Tens of millions of spores yes, that are being spread from the
And the same thing happened uh-huh. With the you know flies and bees. They just force these animals, you know, these organisms to go high up and then spread. So,
why do you think that this happens more often in like insects than other organisms? I don't know if you have an answer. I don't know.
I mean, in a way, it's probably the whole thermal, you know, regulation part of it. But it's probably also the fact that they are cohabitant. You know, they're living in the same places, the same environments. Yeah. So that's probably was selected over evolution.
Right.
Yeah. But I don't know of any example of a warm-blooded animal that can happen.
Yeah,
right.
But it's mostly it's mostly insects.
Mostly insects because they are cold-blooded, so they just have room temperature essentially. Yeah.
But that's probably as I'm sure you probably know, this has give Hollywood a lot of imagination.
Oh yes, yes. So Maggie, you watch that show.
We have to talk about The Last of Us. You've spoken about this in other contexts as well, but season two I think is coming.
Yes,
so
yes.
Let's talk about it, which is
I'm gonna have to catch up on that show.
It's super good.
Okay.
It's more terrifying than like traditional zombies, I think, because they move so fast in the show. But essentially a fungus has taken over and everyone is controlled by fungus and growing crazy fruiting bodies out of them, and it's an apocalyptic thing. So
it is a pretty good show.
And I
know, I mean, it's based on a game. I've never played the game, apparently it's one of the most famous games. But it's funny also how in the game or in the show they're never called zombies. Yet people immediately associate them with like, oh, these are zombies. They're not zombies, they're just infected people. And like Maggie said, they just have these fruiting bodies coming out of them and they're being controlled. And the reason they're controlled is that they just want to spread. They want to spread to other people.
Yeah, they just want to share that. Maybe we should reframe them as, what's the word? Like generous giving things. I just want to share the wealth.
Sure. Now I really want to watch that show.
But on the show, at the beginning, the first episode, they have scientists like back in the 70s or whatever kind of saying some of these similar things, that this is a possibility.
With climate change
and talking about this temperature. So, you know, the show is feasible in some ways, but we're probably a long way out.
No, definitely. Which is why, going back to what I was saying at the beginning, one of the reasons I like about science fiction shows is when they use kind of real science.
Mm-hmm.
So even if it's far-fetched, there's this little probability that it might be real.
Yeah.
So I think that's what makes this very, very good show, at least to me, is that they're using basic, real science, and then they're stretching it a little bit, but
they're stretching it quite a bit.
But definitely, a fungus that's adapted to like control an ant, will not be able to control you. I mean, the nervous system of the ant is so much different than our nervous system, so it's just not gonna work on that. And even if it now gained the ability to survive at high temperature, the immune system of the ant is pretty much very bad relative to our immune system. Our immune system is so good. So it will have to also gain an ability to evade our own. Yeah. So there's so many other things that it had to happen. Right. Mm-hmm. So very unlikely that something like The Last of Us will happen.
Yeah.
But what is more feasible and what something that could happen is that something like with the Candida auris example I mentioned at the beginning, is that now we have a new fungus that can infect us and kill us, and that there's no way to treat it. I think that's even worse than something like The Last of Us. You know,
growing
like,
out of your head. Yeah,
yeah. You get infected, and then it's a death sentence. Yeah. You'll die. There's nothing that we can do. Yeah. And that is a very real possibility.
Yeah.
That can happen. So it's not, I don't think, you know, I think The Last of Us gets people's attention, which to me was great. It's bringing awareness of fungal infections. It's very, you know, very unlikely that something like that could happen. Yeah. But it is very likely that you could get infected and die because we just don't have very effective treatments to treat fungal infections.
So there's a lot that needs to be done in the field, of course. We need more funding, more attention, more scientists.
Correct. No, and that's, I think that's why I was very happy recently WHO came out with a list of fungal pathogens that they consider are the most critical, mostly to raise awareness, but also to direct, you know, governments and other stakeholders to tell them, like, hey, we need to support this and we need to put, you know, resources on this.
Right.
And if you think about it, you know, if you think about TB or you think about malaria or these other very well-known diseases, they affect millions of people.
Yes.
But if you consider the mortality, it's pretty low.
Yeah.
And the reason the mortality is low is because of all of these research that has been done that have figured out ways to, even if not, you know, treat it very effectively, but at least treat them in a way that the patients can survive.
Lower the burden of the disease and lower the mortality and so on. Yeah.
And, you know, you look at the mortality of those diseases, it's less than 1%.
Sure, yeah.
Now, you think about the mortality of the fungal infections that we're talking about, these invasive fungal infections, and they're over 40, 50, 60%.
Wow.
Thankfully, they don't affect too much people. Just certain populations only that are affected. But for those population, you know, it's pretty bad. It's almost like a death sentence.
50-50.
I mean, it's pretty bad.
Yeah, and as a doctor, as a healthcare provider, you're pretty much helpless.
Correct. And another you know, mention of climate change, there are some of these fungal pathogens like histoplasma or coccidioides. They are considered primary pathogens, so you don't have to have a defect in your immune system.
Mm.
But traditionally, you know, these infections, these pathogens have been restricted to very small areas of the world.
Okay.
Hence, very few people are exposed to them.
Right.
But with climate change and urbanization and deforestation, so these, what used to be very small areas, are expanding.
Yeah.
And the result of that is that now more people are exposed to them. And these are primary pathogens.
Yeah.
So now more people are also getting these diseases. And these are fungal infections. So they're going to suffer from the same thing that I mentioned before. There's very few antifungals. They're very toxic. They're very challenging. Many physicians might not be aware of these diseases because they used to be very small to certain places. So if you were a physician living there, you might know about them and you might have that in your list of your differential diagnosis.
Yeah.
But now also with ease of traveling and moving around, people could go to one of these places, get the disease, go back to their home place where that disease is not common, but now they develop the symptoms. Physicians over there, in their list of potential candidates, that is not going to be there.
They have no idea.
So it is, you know, another reason why climate change is also increasing fungal infections, and that's another reason why the incidence of some of these infections is increasing, which is why WHO is trying to, like, bring awareness to that.
This might be a stupid question, but how do fungal infections actually spread from person to person, right? I don't know. I have no idea.
So that's not a stupid question. I think that's a great
like,
question.
I should probably know this, but I don't actually
that's
know.
That's a great question. That in fact, they don't.
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's what I assumed.
They don't.
So they don't need us. Fungi don't need a person to like replicate or survive mm-hmm. like the same way like these other fungi need an ant, right? Mm-hmm. So when we get infected by one of these invasive fungal infections, we died, the fungi died too with us. Yeah. So there's no benefit for the fungi.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's almost like the fungus is like, oh no, oh crap, I just killed
I mean, they're
this person.
Trying to do their best to survive inside you. Yeah. They don't want to die.
Right.
And in trying to do that, they killed you.
Yeah.
But as far as I know, none of these very big invasive fungal infections are transmittable person to person. Right. Now, some of the superficial ones are transmittable person to person or even sexually. Like if you have like a yeast vaginal infection.
Yes.
But if you think about it, again, those superficial ones are, they don't kill you. You know, they can be transmitted from person to person. They will not kill you. The invasive ones, those are the ones that kill you. As far as I know, knock on wood, they are not transmitted person to person. But that actually will be like a worst case scenario.
Yes, worst case.
That would be like something.
Yeah.
If that were to happen, then that has potential to become like a big pandemic, like in The Last of Us.
Yeah. Because
we're not flying tree rats, so that's why.
Yeah. I mean, it would make sense that if something, it's actually not beneficial for any organism to kill you if it needs you to survive.
Right. Correct.
So that's why they don't. Aren't as common. Probably, I would think.
Correct, and you think about it. There's this. I cannot remember what's the actual phrase, but in the virus world. You know, viruses that kill you very fast, they don't tend to like spread. And they're contained.
Yeah, like Ebola, for example, usually burns itself out very quickly. Has a 90% or something death rate.
So then viruses that basically cause a mild, disease that don't kill you, those are the ones that have huge potential to spread throughout the whole world.
Right.
So the pathogen really is not under benefits to kill you. They don't want to kill you because they will die. So with fungi, they don't need you. This is just an accidental, infection that happened. Mm-hmm. You inhaled them and now they found themselves inside you, very, very inhospitable environment. They want to do all they can to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And with Cryptococcus, for example, Crypto is in the environment. And there are some predators of Crypto in the environment. This amoeba lives, this free-living amoeba, they want to eat Crypto. So Crypto has deployed, has developed these ways to avoid being killed by the amoeba.
Yeah.
So what happened? You inhale Crypto, and now Crypto is inside you, and then your immune cells look a lot like amoebas.
Yeah, that are trying to eat the...
And they're like, this is an amoeba that wants to eat me. So they're going to use the same things that they use in the environment to survive. They're going to use that inside you.
Wow. Okay. I see. Yeah.
So they don't want to kill you. They just want to survive. But eventually, in doing so, they will kill you and they will also die.
Is there... So you talked about how treatment for some of these diseases is more difficult because they're so much like our own human cells. What about preventative... I have just a million questions.
Oh, these are great questions.
Are there preventative measures? Like we have things for malaria, net, right, to stop. What about for...
So that's an excellent question. There are no vaccines. There are no vaccine for any fungal pathogens. They don't exist. There's a lot of interest, especially for... You could imagine a situation where you're a person that is part of a susceptible group.
Mm-hmm.
Then a vaccine will be great for you. I mentioned before, for example, organ transplantations are one of those processes that nowadays make you very susceptible. So, and one reason is that, number one, you don't know if the donor of the organ had Cryptococcus, for example.
Oh, yeah.
You don't know that.
Yeah.
Because many of us have it and we show no symptoms.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then you get that organ, you are immunocompromised so that you don't reject the organ. So now that crypto that was inside that organ can grow.
You're literally infecting the recipient.
So you could imagine a situation like that where like a person like that is immunocompromised, and you could get a vaccine. And then you can get the organ, and it doesn't, you know, you already have developed protection.
Yeah. Mm.
So it doesn't really matter. So there are no vaccines. There are no preventative treatments. Like when you go to Africa, they will give, you know, for malaria, they will give you some antibiotics and as preventative treatment. There's nothing like that for fungal infections. There are only three classes of antifungals that can be used to treat an infection.
Yeah.
And they all suffer from one or more disadvantages that can be toxicity, can be availability. So many places in the world, they just don't have it. Mm-hmm. Can also, there's very little broad effectiveness. Many times it only work in one, but not in others. Right. So there's no such thing as a like broad spectrum
antifungal. That will kill basically all fungi. Yeah,
correct. And they can be very expensive.
Yeah.
They can be very expensive. So it's very suboptimal treatment. So I think that's one of the reasons also that mortality is so high. Yeah. Mm.
Mm. So, I mean, you bring a lot of attention to something that is definitely under research and where we need a lot more people to really pay attention to it.
Yeah, which is why when that Last of Us came and everybody all of a sudden start talking about fungi, I was like, oh, this is awesome. Perfect. This is great. Everybody's just like talking about fungi. Uh-huh. Hopefully that's when season two comes out, you know, that's going to start again.
Well, hopefully we'll see the Last of Us bump in researchers.
Yeah.
Hopefully be a new generation of Gen Z who are interested in fungal research. I think that would be really wonderful.
And we do. There's a clear need. We need to find ways to treat this. If it's something like a vaccine, that would be awesome. Mm-hmm. There's also other types of antifungal, independent type of way that we can try to do. For example, when we mentioned before, the prostheses or the medical devices. You know, one of the main reasons that we get infected is because that's a platform. Mm-hmm. You know, they make a platform for the fungus to make a biofilm.
Right.
So you could imagine situations where, you know, material sciences comes into the equation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, engineering
nice.
Comes into mm-hmm. the equation where, you know, you develop, you know, prostheses that are, you know, biofilm resistant or something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And so those are ways also to kind of prevent these types of infections that are independent of like drugs or things like that. And like also ways to like maybe have medical interventions that are not going to also destroy your immune system.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a fair point. That kind of going even farther back in the in why there's more prevalence and adjusting those things as well.
Yeah. So we have the $1 million question for you. The $1 million question is, do you like mushrooms on your pizza?
Yeah, I do, actually. I do like mushrooms on my pizza. But you know, somebody else have to like cook them, and I would not do it myself.
And make sure that they are not the poisonous
Correct.
ones.
Yeah, I will trust the chef. Yeah. And then I'll eat them.
Yeah, wonderful.
That is the correct answer.
That is the correct answer.
Mushrooms are delicious.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you so much for being here. This is so cool. I was so excited to have you come on and talk. People can check out your talk that you gave here at the local library about The Last of Us as well. We'll link that in our show notes.
Thank you for inviting me. It was a lot of fun.
And before we go, is there anything you want the listeners to know that we didn't get to ask you about, or you know, what do you wish people took away about fungus when they go home today or something?
About fungus
or anything, if there's anything else, you know, what is the thing you want to leave people with before we go?
Well, I mean, I maybe not necessarily just about fungi, but it will be, you know, I will like let people know, you know, there are researchers that are experts in the fields that are doing, you know, they're devoting their whole life to study something. And they do know what they're doing. So to just pay attention to those researchers rather than doing their own like Google thing and then find some other.
That's true.
Nowadays, you know, there's so much misinformation over there. Yeah. It can very easily, you know, derail you and think on doing something that you should not do.
So
listening to things like this, you know, this is great. I think scientific communication is very important. And if there are like public talks about that around where people live, you know, go.
Wonderful.
Take a leap, go and hear from them.
Seek information, find a scientist.
Yeah, I think any scientist I've ever talked to would be happy to talk about their research for a very long time.
That's what we like to do.
You know, it's just a bunch of nerds who like what they do. They're not really out there trying to, they don't have an agenda other than just to learn and explore.
Correct.
And we're not trying to hide anything. I mean, like, we get so excited.
I know.
There is this misconception that, like, oh, all of these scientists, they're getting paid by pharma. You know, I wish, you know, I mean, nobody's paying me anybody. Like, we don't have a secret agenda or anything like that. But I think scientific, you know, communication and outreach is most important now that it has been ever. Because it's so easy to like get derailed with misinformation nowadays.
Right.
So I think shows like these are going to become very important and making them very accessible and easy to find and easy to follow. I think that's just going to be very important.
Well, that's wonderful. And we thank you for making that possible by coming on our show.
Coming on here and talking about.
My pleasure. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Felipe.
Thank you. At the end of our show, we would like to thank you, our lovely listener, and our awesome audience for spending your time with us. We thank the Notre Dame College of Science and the Indiana University South Bend College of Arts and Sciences. Special thanks to the wonderful people at the Notre Dame Studios. Coming to you from beautiful South Bend, Indiana, in the heart of the Rust Belt, this is Rust Belt Science. I'm Shahir Risk.
And I'm Maggie Fink.
And we'll catch you next time.